This is a story of when we were once bored in Italy, and we decrypted a bunch of notes written by a World War II Italian spy. In 2003, he wrote a letter, and asking if he were able to ask for help to decrypt notes. He forgot how to decrypt them. Attached to this letter, there were a bunch of papers with random letters on them. So this person, who was this person? Who was Antonio Marzi? World War II started in 1939. In 1940, Italy joins Germany and the Nazis. And this is when this young guy at 16 comes in. He volunteers to be a radio operator in Italian Royal Navy, and he gains a War Merit Cross doing that. Then in 1943, Italy officially surrenders to the Allies that comes into southern Italy and start occupying the territory. It's worth noting, northern Italy was still occupied by the Germans. The ship where Marzi was in is towed over in southern Italy, and he lands in Brindisi. So there were not a lot of people able to operate really big radio. So after a year, he volunteers to be parachuted behind enemy lines in northern Italy and communicate notes to the Allies. So he was parachuted in Verona and then took a bike and biked 120 miles with a 40 pounds radio on his back. So he landed in northern Italy in 1944, and he stayed there until the war finished in 1945. So after the war finished, he moved to Rome, and when he was about 80, he asked for help to decrypt those notes because he couldn't remember how to do that. He also mentions his education is from a middle school background, and he has a terrible handwriting. Note, that is from 1940s. We then came in. We found these notes on a puzzle site called Mystery Twister, and since we had basically nothing to do, we decided to take a train, cross all Italy by train, and pick them up. Yes, there were 75 pages of encrypted notes.
Along the 75 pages of encrypted notes, Marzi tried to leave behind some instructions on how to decrypt them. He leaves this page with a partial mapping between letters and words, a five-digit number of unclear use, some instructions on how to do an old cipher called the columnar transposition, which is usually done with a key, but there is no suggestion of that in the paper with his instructions. And he just scribbles a note saying that he really hopes that this will be helpful, but he can't remember anything else about what he was doing when he was encrypting those notes. Again, by now he's 80 and trying to remember what he was doing when he was 18? 21 behind enemy lines. Now, something that we know about that time is that the spies in behind enemy lines were mostly organized by the Special Operations Executive. This is a secretive agency formed in 1940 with explicit mandate of set Europe ablaze. They take care of espionage and sabotage in occupied Europe, and they provide training and help to the resistance forces in the occupied territories. They were sometimes referred to as the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Today, we can find their manual, their training manuals in the National Archives. And there's a very good republishing of the syllabus. And right between invisible inks and innocent messages, there is an explanation of how to use the double columnar transposition to encrypt messages. By the way, this is a fascinating document, covering topics from cryptography to the art of silent killing and how to hide on trees. But the part we're interested in, the secret codes, are covered more in depth in the semi-autobiographical book Between Silk and Cyanide, written by Leo Marx, who was the head cryptographer at the SOE. And in that book, he explains how they moved on from these ciphers that he refers to as poem codes to one-time pads on silk. The poem codes used to work like this. You would have a key that would be a word or two words or three words, and you would use it to figure out, to order the columns of a grid. So, for example, you would take cryptography as your keyword for this message, and you would start going through it in alphabetical order. The first letter in alphabetical order is the A. So that's going your first column when you're doing the transposition. And then you continue through the alphabet. There's no B, so we move on to C, and there's a C, that's going to be the second column. I'm not going to talk through each step, don't worry. But you can see how this proceeds through every letter and all the way to the Y, the latest letter in the alphabet in the word, of which we have two, so we number column 11 and column 12. So now we have an order for 12 columns. Underneath that, we write in a grid our encrypted message. For example, Antonio Marzi was parachuted into Italian territory under German occupation. This is what we want to encrypt. And then we follow the order we just wrote at the top. We start with the first column, and we read it as a column, and we write it down as a row. This is why columnar transposition. The letters of the encrypted messages are the same, but they're in a different order. So we copy the first column, then the second column, and the message is starting to get scrambled because the order of these columns come from a secret word. We move through the whole message, until we copied all the words in the all the columns in the plain text. Now, if this were the entire cipher, it wouldn't be that hard to decrypt because you can imagine that you just have to figure out where to make the cuts. And then you're playing columnar anagrams. You just have to figure out which one goes first. This gets significantly safer against anyone without a computer, which at the time was everyone, if you do it twice. So double columnar transposition. This is the process to encrypt something with this cipher at the core of the poem codes. And then usually the ciphertext was split into five-letter groups to be transmitted over telegraph. So what this is telling us is that these were not notes from a journal or personal notes, but were texts pre-encrypted to be transmitted over radio, the radio that he was carrying behind the Nazi lines. Decryption works pretty much in reverse. You figure out the secret word, which we don't know yet how, and then you number the columns, you write out the grid, and you copy things from rows to columns. So far, so good? Got the cipher? Okay. Now, what we used, now we need to confirm that that was indeed what Marzi used, because this was just an assumption based on what we knew about the SOE. We did that using something that in modern cryptography you would call a side channel. In modern cryptography, side channels are timing attacks or power consumption, but in general they are something that leaks information about the functioning of a crypto system beyond the output that it's supposed to emit. And while, yeah, side channels in CPUs might be power consumption, side channels in classical cryptography are dots. So those dots over there tell us something about the text. Can you imagine why they're there? They're not periods semantically. They are about, he was writing a dot every time he was copying a column from the other grid, which was lost, into the final message. So what this tells us is the length of each column. Now, if we count the letters in each column that we figured out from the dots, in this message, for example, they would be all 24 or 23 letters long, except the first one and the bottom one. The first one is 29 characters, the last one is 28. All the other ones, 24 and 23. Why aren't they all the same length? Because the last row at the bottom is incomplete. So columns that come to the right of that will be one shorter than the columns copied from the left-hand side. So this tells us that there's something extraneous that doesn't come from the plain text in the ciphertext. There's 5 extra characters at the beginning and 5 extra characters at the bottom. We don't know exactly where, but they're in the first column and in the last column to be copied. Now, looking more closely at other messages, we start seeing places where the first block was forgotten. We have reason to think that it was probably the fourth block, the extraneous one, because we have all these messages where he either went back and scratched what he was copying to insert these other letters, or just forgot to put them in and added them on top. Now, for example, here we can think that the letters H, T, X, T, R are from something else than the plain text because they weren't copied from the grid in the previous round of the transposition. The position of the last extraneous block, instead, is a bit harder to find, but some texts have a dot almost at the end of the text, leaving out only one block of 5 letters. So that suggests that the last, very, very last block is the extraneous one added on top. So something that you might know from studying classic cryptography is that usually there was a per message key or per day key. For example, if you know about the Enigmas, they often had per day keys that were transmitted over more long-term keys. So it's reasonable to think that those 5 extra letters are somehow communicating the per message key, and they somehow lead to figuring out the words to write at the top of the grid to reorder the columns in the right way. Now, the mortal sin of classic cryptography is key reuse. And these two messages, written one above the other on the same piece of paper, have a repetition. If you can see it. The fourth block of the first message is the last block of the second message, and vice versa. Now, one word in favor of Antonio Marzi. You have imagined that you're doing this after getting trained for a few months by these British people, and the Nazis are chasing you down, and you will have to transmit this with a radio that is being tracked down with radiogoniometric equipment to find you and kill you. So yes, this wasn't easy. So we also verified that the keys is the same in the two messages by comparing the patterns of the dots. They come at the exact same positions in the two messages. But they're swapped. So that suggests that those two blocks are the same thing. They mean the same thing because you can use them interchangeably, just encoded somehow differently. We don't know how yet. There's a number of messages that somehow reuse partial keys or entire keys. And in the SOA manual, we find a section that says to use some personal number to encode the key that you're using for each message. And indeed, Marzi does write down that there was this personal number, 5 digits, just like the 5 letters. So how this was probably working is like with Caesar ciphers, where you take the alphabet and you move off four positions in the alphabet to change the letter. So probably the first letter would be moved by four, second by four, third by seven, nine, seven, nine, three, nine. Now, this would be reasonable to think, but if we try it with the alphabet like written down in Marx's instruction, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work with that alphabet. It doesn't work with that alphabet without the R, E, N, A, T, O letters at the bottom. So, and the words in here are also repeated, which is quite unlikely that he would actually use words that repeat in a key, making the key weaker. So we have to think that there's something wrong in the alphabet that he's using and in the mapping to words. But if we find a way to go from those blocks of five letters to the words that they map into, those words will probably be the key for the transposition. Thankfully, we have this example on one of the pages. This example shows how to decode some key blocks, but it doesn't use key blocks that show up in any of the messages he sent. What we think happened is that he was also receiving encrypted messages with the same system and the same number. But of course, he was doing the operation in reverse, and we somehow lost the decryption of those messages. So what we have here is exactly what we want to learn how to do, how to use 44739 to turn the key at the top into the key at the bottom to decrypt a message. In other words, this is a unit test. And this is where computers come in. When you have to go doing wild guesses about what the alphabet is and what the mechanism is, computers can do that instantaneously. You just write one line of Python to test your assumption, and then you run it against a unit test, and if it turns OGWVQ into EBLFQF, bingo. If it doesn't, next try. Now, something we observed is that a lot of the keys had letters that are not present in the Italian alphabet. Marzi had over here, he only has letters from the Italian alphabet. You can see that there's no K, there's no J, there's no X, Y, and K. The Italian alphabet is five fewer letters than the English alphabet. But the letters are present in the key. So probably that was the first of his mistakes when recollecting how this worked. And also we see that he somehow was taking R-E-N-A-T-O out, but we don't know exactly why. There's literally nothing in the letter about why he wrote Renato right there. It turns out that this is how you have to arrange the alphabet for the decoding to work. The R-E-N-A-T-O letters first, and then all the other letters from the English alphabet. And I'm not going to tell you how we figured this out, because there's not really how, because we just were trying things until one stick. And it stuck because we have a unit test, and if you try it out yourself, you can see that if you take the O, you go back four steps, you land on an E. And then you take the G, go back four steps, and you land on a B. W, seven steps back, L. V, three steps back, Q. Q, nine steps back, F. Unit test pass. We know what the key is. So now that we know how to decode the key, we would expect them to come out equal, the first, the one at the top, and the one at the beginning, and at the end of the messages, because we know they're interchangeable. They don't. So these are pairs. Each row is a single message. So they're both taken from the same message. Can you see a way to make them equivalent? If you take out, again, R-E-N-A-T-O, the letters that he left aside without telling us why, if you take them out of these keys, they are equivalent to each other. So that suggests that the letters R, E, N, A, T, O don't map to any word. They're just there to make the key harder to figure out. They're nulls. So if we now take this order of the alphabet and we map the remaining white letters to words from this key, we get probably finally the keys for the transposition. By the way, these words came from a poem, and we came full circle about why they're called poem codes, written by Aleardo Aleardi. It's a snippet from the middle of one of the canti, Il Monte Circello. And some of the words were a bit different, some of the words were collapsed, so we didn't really have the whole key yet. We started seeing some ciphertext decrypting and some wouldn't. For example, this message wasn't decrypting with the mappings as he suggested them. And again, we used our dots. The dots tell us the height of the previous grid, because they tell us how long each column is. And if we know how long each column is, and we know how many letters there are in the message, we also know how wide it's going to be. And the width of the message is the length of the key. Now, C always mapped to Giovinetto. It mapped to Giovanetto, but close enough. While P mapped to something completely different. And it was too short for the size of that grid. But the letter that was supposed to map to Q, Sventurato, would have been perfect. So, not Q, sorry, the letter before P. So what was happening is that there was probably a missing letter. The M was mapping to something else, and it was just moving all the words one down in the alphabet so that Sventurato would fall on P. So what's happening here is that C turns into Giovinetto, P turns into Sventurato, we have the right width of the grid, we turn the grid into ordering of the columns, and we decrypt the message. So close! This message would still not decrypt. What was wrong about this one is that the first column was short, not long. And we knew that, again, from the dots. And the first column, instead, when we started decrypting this, this said Giovanetto, with an A on top of that red column. A would have made it the first column. But that couldn't be right because the first column had to be short. So we knew that it wasn't Giovanetto. And again, computers are quick, and we just tried different vowels until the thing sorted into the right order. So finally, this is the complete mapping with all the misspellings out of the way of letters to keywords to decrypt the messages. Now, this might have sounded painful, but it was actually way more linear, how I just told you, than what actually happened. This was a story, I told you a story of how we figure out one thing, and then the next thing, and then that led to another thing, and things like leads to thing, and now we have a key. Not how it happened. This took months. Some of the assumptions were completely wrong and led to long chases of red herrings. Sometimes we would have the right assumption, but no way to confirm it. So no way to know if we should invest time figuring that out. Sometimes my code had bugs. sometimes you would just come to the conclusion in three different ways at the same time. And that's how you knew it was right, but also I'm not presenting you three different explanations for each thing, because that would be boring. But yes, this took months, and by the way, just 1 month before we decrypted it, we got scooped by a German amateur cryptographer, Armin Krauss, in April 2013. We had the final decryptions a couple months after that. However, something that he did not do was publish the whole decryptions. And we suspect that there was one of the reasons he did not do that right away is that he did not speak Italian, because the hard work wasn't done after decrypting the messages.
So it was not only a matter of knowing Italian, but was also a matter of transcribing letters into the computer. So sometimes it was easy, sometimes it was not. It took a lot of nights and hours for us to figure out all the papers. And then once we decrypted them, we needed to add spaces. It can be easy, it can be not easy, especially when the notes comes from the previous century, and there are name of villages that you don't know, or maybe do not exist anymore, or you know, words changes over time, so different spellings. And he made some grammatical errors as well, so they were not easy to read. Once we put all the spaces in, we needed to figure out a way to sort these codes. Every snippet started with random letters and a number written in Roman letters, and then a day. So these particular snippets translate in number 82, day 27. Again, this is now all easy, but it was not reading it for the first time after 70 years. So those snippets are not just about war, but they were also about how to synchronize with the Allies in order to be able to communicate. So he tries to different channels, different quartz, and in order to be able to receive and send communications. And yes, all really quartz, not frequencies or knobs. Those are actual stones there. After reading all of them, we put them on a map. This is northern Italy. That area is eastern Italy. The borders now are different. Once we had all this peninsula here, was called Italy as well, and the border was running across there-ish. So we mapped all of them. They cover a pretty big area. It's around 5,600 square miles. And the longest line you can trace from one point to another is around 170 miles. It will take now 3 hours, 3 hours and a half by car to cover all that road. So you can imagine under war, by bike, it was not an easy job. Taking a closer look, there were a lot of places. Some of them are not in this slide. I wasn't able to trace all the villages down. Sometimes he mentioned this family's farm, and obviously I don't know what the family was. So, yeah. After putting them on a map, we created a timeline. We know these are the notes from the last month of war. War ended officially April 25 in 1945 in Italy. And these are all the notes that we have. Maybe there were some more, but we don't know. We can see how he started sending a lot more communication during the last days of the liberation of northern Italy. But maybe we lost more in the first week of April. So it was obvious how this project would turn out to be personal for us. My family is from that area. We suffered a lot from the Second World War. All northern Italy actually took a really harsh hit during World War II. So we went through all the messages and really felt them. We thought it was worth dividing them in three different topics. The first one is the logistics, targets, and damage reports. So here it was at the beginning of the month. He was helping the Allies for airstrikes. He was telling them where to hit the Nazis, where their ammunition for aircraft were, and that they were not enough. They were using them a lot. Then later on, the Allies were approaching from east, and the Germans were starting to retreat, right? So He sent this note about that particular road on the coast that was bringing to the eastern docks of Italy. He in particular mentioned minefields here and states of roads and bridges. So the Germans left behind some minefields for the Allies to step in. Hopefully he saved a couple of lives. Maybe more, yeah. So, yeah, then the Germans started to retreat north because they had Yugoslavic people coming from the east, allies, British people coming from the west. So the Germans started going north, and so he was reporting the state of roads and passages up in the mountains. In this particular passage, she claims that in order to block a crossing of a river, you needed to destroy both footbridges. After doing a lot of logistics, he also talked about people moods and how the city was actually failing. An army is occupying your city, it's not always easy, and people can create problems. So, also useful information, right? In this particular snippet, he is talking about police shooting young people in prisons. The Nazis actually set up an extraordinary court to condemn people to death before the Allies actually came into the territory. And they did that pretty quickly. I wouldn't be here if the Allies hadn't liberated them. My grandfather was one of those young guys condemned to death. So I'm pretty glad this communication were actually being sent. Also, the Patriots are buzzing. So there are people that want to do something, that want to take actions. Afterwards, so the Allies can keep coming in. The Germans do not know where to go. Some German troops, in this particular snippet, were 5,000 people from the opposite army, didn't know where to go. They were pushed back from Yugoslavia, and they didn't know if they wanted to go back to Germany's camps or being deserters up in Italian mountains. Both options were risky at the time because we had resistance in the mountains from the patriots, the partisans, and going back to your camps cannot always be safe, right? He also describes the parties and the resistance taking action. Those groups were not always organized. They didn't actually respond to an organization. In big cities, especially in Milan, they had some sort of hierarchy and someone that was sending orders. But in the mountains, no one cared. They did a lot of guerrilla warfare, and they tried in vain taking some cities, but they always failed until the army arrived, the Allies' army arrived. So after a while, Germans start to be desperate, and they start taking arms from the Italian army. They start to attack the finance guard and militia, taking their arms, and the city life is obviously disrupted. This is also the only note where Marzi sends a personal line stating, "Dr. Rob, remember my family, regards, Mario." We do not know who Mario was. It might be another name he was using under enemy lines. Marzi, Mario, can make sense. But it can also be a hidden message in there. And this is the only time he writes something personal in these in 75 pages. We find that interesting as well. And finally, the advance of the Allies and the liberation of Trieste. So Trieste is the easternmost city in Italy, and it's just right on the border. And it has a particular history for the World War II. So let's start at the beginning. The Allies arrived in Trieste, and people were celebrating. They were showing joy, I guess. Yes, joy. They sent the National Liberation Committee, that was the political umbrella of the partisan resistance, to send notice to Venice and ask to support from the royal government. The Germans at the beginning refused to actually give in, but then the English arrived and they surrendered. On the same day, the same note, he also mentions Slavic authorities, and this is crucial because they started taking occupancies of Trieste, hanging on posters in their own language, not in Italian, and imposing their own time zone. And that was an Italian city. So they were basically occupying the city soon after the Germans were kicked out of it. He sent another note from the same day, just some like later on, saying that the situation is fine, tragic. So in the same day, he goes from, hey, we are celebrating a lot, and people do manifest a lot of demonstrate a lot of positive feelings, and they're celebrating, but then the situation is becoming tragic. It was a really quick coup, I guess. So terrorist runs in the city where bread and food are missing. The people of Trieste, the Italian people of Trieste, are waiting for the support of other Italian cities. They were the last Italian city to be liberated from the Nazis. The English authorities that were there that helped them liberate the city from the Nazis do not know what to do because it was a political mess, right? Also, it's worth remembering, the borders were not like this at the time. All this area here was Italy. So Yugoslavic people took the city, and then they kept going north. This is the last of our notes. As I said, the borders were not like that. But they were probably going near Udine. So here he's complaining about Yugoslavic people taking Italian people and deporting them to Bosnia. He's also complaining that they are seizing every house for food and clothes. And the bishop is declared enemy of the of a public enemy, and he flees the city and goes back to Rome. So he also clearly communicated the intentions of Yugoslavic people to keep going until the river called Tagliamento, that I think is in this area. It was a really tough period for Italy, especially for Trieste. The Second World War was officially over, and they were still fighting another war, and that's not always mentioned in the history we usually study. So this was the last note from Antonio Marzi that we have now. He died in 2007, so he never saw his notes decrypted in time. And kind of sorry for that. This has been really important in my my life and understanding of my family. We also are really glad to have these notes. We think we have them because he was usually destroying them every month, but then he saw the war being almost over and decided to keep them. So we might have not been able to get them if we decided to stick to the protocol and destroy them. So, yeah.
I think we have some time for questions. We are not historians, so take it easy. please. I think I'm holding the questions microphone. Am I? No? Okay, cool. So I can't see anything, so someone will have to handle questions.
Hi, I'm at the microphone. Hello. So now that you've accomplished this great goal, are there other letters of encrypted Italian that you're now working on?
There's none I'm aware of.
Okay.
The website where these were found also had a number of other challenges in the undeciphered section, but some are fairly unreasonable, like the RSA factoring challenge with keys of size 4096. Thank you. and others are the very famous and well-studied BL ciphertext and along those lines. This was one of the least knowns on that side.
So thanks. Thanks for a terrific talk and an interesting story behind it. So I have a question. You say you're not historians, although I think you are now. what is...
Thank you.
Obviously, this seems historically significant and historically interesting. What's being done with the results of these plain texts that you've discovered?
They're public on the internet. There's a website about them. We thought about printing them in a book with some maps and some historical context, but we never actioned on it.
Yeah, to be clear, these were decrypted by other people, and they have been since passed to Italian people that did decode them and put them on the internet in the 5 years since we finished decrypting them. This is just the first time we published our process to get to them and our version of them.
Thank you again. Have you made any... presumably these messages were being sent to someone in a government position and they were being archived somewhere. Have you ever tried to compare the two sides?
I tried. I tried to ask a bunch of questions to different people that might know the answer, but it's hard to find these things online, especially when they're from the government.
The British National Archives do have now the SOA training manuals, but at the time it was an extremely secretive agency. I don't have reason to believe they survived the decryptions for the other side, and if they did, we didn't find them.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.